and hinders the path. It increases the defilements. While flexing and extending your limbs, this quite likely has to do with arms round, right? You are kind of giving out your bowl, and then you're flexing your limbs because you're putting out your bowl to receive alms food. A lot of these things have to do with the practice of monastics, so it has to do with going on alms round and these kind of things. So this is the sort of things I think somebody pointed out that you do when you're not doing formal, not sitting down to do meditation practice. This is what all the other stuff that happen in daily life and how to deal with those. Again, acting in full awareness when wearing the robe and carrying his outer robe and bowl. This has almost certainly to do with alms round, or you're going there for some other reason. Full awareness in eating, drinking, consuming and tasting. You know the right amount, you know what is suitable. Full awareness in defecating and urinating. That I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means in terms of being wise about it, I guess. But anyway. And then the last one is about walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up and talking and keeping silent. So this is, again, this is an interesting one. Most of those are fairly obvious, walking, standing, sitting. You know where is appropriate, where you shouldn't be doing it, etc. Falling asleep. Really, what that means is not falling asleep. It means being asleep. You know the right amount of sleep, right? It's like when you come on a retreat like this, sometimes you find you're not sleeping enough. You're probably too many hours awake. And then you feel tired. Or you're sleeping too much. One day you kind of, oh, no, I had enough. And you just kind of crash out in your bed. And you sleep. And then, this happens sometimes. And then you feel really groggy afterwards if you sleep too much. So it's about finding that balance. And this is clear comprehension about sleep. And the same thing about being awake. And the same thing with talking and keeping silent. You know the purpose of the talk. You know why you're doing it. You're doing it for the right reason. So this is the summary of what this is about. Now to get a bit more handle on what this is about, I'm going to look at another sutta. And this is the one which comes afterwards here. This is Majjhima number 2, called All the Tanks. This is the Sabbasava Sutta in the Pali. And this is quite a well-known sutta. You will often hear it spoken about. And this sutta is almost also a kind of gradual training. It shows you the training from the moment you attain right view all the way up to awakening. There's a similar kind of thing we're looking at now, but it's termed slightly differently. It has a slightly different components to it, if you like. But it's a parallel to the gradual training that we have seen so far here. And sometimes when you read parallel suttas like that, you find that there is a different emphasis and there is an expansion on certain terms, an expansion on other things. So this particular sutta has a long section in the middle that you don't find in the gradual training here. And this section, as far as I can see, is an expansion and an explanation for what clear comprehension actually means. And this is why it's quite interesting here. And how can you tell that that's the case? Well, you can tell because this section comes straight after sense restraint, and then it goes up to the final abandoning of the defilements of the mind. And this is exactly the same place where you find a clear comprehension in the gradual training. So it fits, it's in exactly the same position. So this seems to be an expansion of this. So this is why this is interesting. So let's have a look and see what this says about clear comprehension. How does this actually work out? So this is from the Sabbasava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 2. What taints, these are the asavas by the way, so what asavas, bhikkhu, should be abandoned by using him? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. So this is an example of clear comprehension, right? And you can see how simple it is. It's about how a monk uses his robes. What is the right way of using the robes? And that's all it is about. So this is how you have this for a monastic. It starts off with reflecting wisely. The Pali word for reflecting wisely is yoniso patisanka. Patisanka is a Pali word which means to reflect. And yoniso, you will probably recognize, is the same as yoniso manasikara, right? Wise or proper reflection. So you have to, so already there's a wisdom aspect here. You're wise, and that's why it is similar to sampajanya. Sampajanya is derived from panya, wisdom, and yoniso patisanka is then has a similar kind of meaning. So you have wisdom here, right? You understand what is appropriate, what will decrease the defilements, and what will not increase them. So what is the purpose of the monastic robe? And this is what this tells you. The purpose of the monastic robe is to, obviously, to protect you from the weather, right? To protect you from insects, right? And possibly also from creeping things, or any kind of, also insects, I suppose. That is the purpose, and for the sake of modesty here. So this is what the purpose of the robe is. So why is that even mentioned here? The reason it is mentioned is because as soon as we start to, you know, get into these kind of areas, it's very easy. I mean, look at the world. How do we treat clothes usually? Clothes are usually status symbols, right? We have certain clothes, certain kind of brand names, right? And you've got to have that. If you haven't got that brand, you're not part of the, whatever crowd you want to hang out with or whatever it is. And there's so much of our personality goes into clothes. And the strange thing is that even in monastic circles, you can see that happen sometimes. It's very weird. But actually, it isn't that weird. Because what usually happens is that people do things not so much because they... Often they live the monastic life, perhaps in the first place, not for exactly the most perfect of reasons. And because of that, they get into ideas that, such as, you know, what kind of robe you have to have, what kind of material it should be, what kind of shape it should be. And this happens even in monastic life. And sometimes you hear Ajahn Brahm joking about, oh, you know, I should have a kind of Armani robe, you know, that sort of thing. Then it's not entirely, you know, and completely wrong. There's a little bit of truth in that. Of course, not Armani, that's going too far. But it works, sometimes it works out a little bit like that. So this is the problem. This is just our natural habit of the mind. You move towards these desires in robes. And there, that is where clear comprehension stops, right? Because you're giving rise to desire, craving, attachment to what you're wearing rather than just using it in the right way. So the purpose here is always the middle way, right? The middle way is the way where you're not indulging in the robes, so you are giving rise to defilements, nor are you not using enough of them so that you are, you know, kind of suffering too much. You're walking around with one robe in the middle of winter or whatever and freezing. So you find that middle way where it just works out. And this is, again, to come back to the middle way, clear comprehension in regard to robes. And this is true also on a retreat like this, right? When you're on a retreat like this, you just wear some simple clothes. You don't care too much about what you look like or what things are. You know, you don't have any kind of status ideas and these kind of things. And there's a kind of liberation there, a kind of freedom from the desires, a freedom from being anything in anybody else's eyes or your own eyes. You just are, right? It's just being without trying to fit into certain categories. So this is also relevant for, although it is here specifically related to monastic life, it's also true for lay life, right? Not to be too concerned about these things. And that takes away some of those defilements also in lay life. So this is, I think, is valid across the board for everybody. So find that middle way with clothes, whereby they don't actually become a distraction, but they do their job, and that's really it. So this is the band asavas here. You can see here how the word asava is used. Here it's used very broadly just to mean any kind of defilement, basically, which arises in the mind. Okay, then we have the second one here, more about how to use things properly. Reflecting wisely, he uses alms food, neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, and only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for enduring discomfort, and for assisting the holy life, considering Thus I shall terminate all feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So again, you have this idea that food, you use it for what its purpose is, right? You have a sense of clear comprehension about it. You eat enough to live comfortably, but you don't eat so much that you kind of, you become completely stuffed, and then you fall asleep for long periods and all this kind of things. So again, it's about finding that middle way here, whereby it doesn't give rise to problems and defilements, but you are wise about the food. There's one little point here which is perhaps a little bit interesting, and it's a little bit strange that it has for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness. You know, you're eating for the sake of physical beauty, it seems a little bit, perhaps a little bit strange. And I think the Chinese version of this sutta does not have that in there, and it only has that in, it has that for the robe instead. It's actually for the robe that you use for physical beauty and attractiveness, which kind of makes a little bit of better sense. So this shows you sometimes you have slight variations in the suttas, and sometimes these are faults that have come into the suttas because of the oral transmission, right? Like I was talking about yesterday, has been transmitted orally, and sometimes you get these faults coming in there because of the natural problems of oral transmission. So again, middle way, right? Middle way for food, middle way for robes. This is what this is really about. And then we have reflecting wisely. He uses the resting place only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate, and for enjoying retreat, right? For the seclusion. That is what the resting place is like. So, again, a very important reflection for for monastic and perhaps also for lay Buddhists as well, who are serious about the practice, but especially for monastics, right? It's very easy, again, to fall prey to the defilements, or not only defilements, sometimes it's easy to fall prey to just the way the world works, you know? People want to give you this palace, and you say, okay, whatever, you know, if you really want to give me a palace, I'll take the palace. This can happen so easily, and you see this in the Buddhist world. You see it is very common that lay people, they have a little bit too much faith and perhaps a little bit too much money as well, and then they build these massive things for monastics who they have confidence in, because they think that is good merit, right? But the monastic, if you are wise, should really say, no, this is not going to be helpful. It's going to set the bad example. Even if they happen to be enlightened or whatever, at the very least, they are setting a very bad example for future generations, right? They will do the same thing. The Buddha himself lived in a very simple way, all the way through his life, wandering around from place to place. And that is the ideal. It's just enough for warding off the weather. That's all that's required. Only a small, tiny little place that you can crawl into and you can sit there when it's pouring down outside or it's cold or whatever. That is the purpose of the monastic dwelling. And if you get into these big things, actually, is it good karma at all to build these things? I think sometimes it is a very big misunderstanding of what Buddhism is about. And actually, sometimes I wonder whether it's good karma or bad karma to build these big things. Because you're helping to bring Buddhism down, right? You're not doing what is going to be supportive for the Buddhist teachings in the future. And there is sometimes this kind of agreement between monastics and lay people. Okay, the agreement is that the lay people supply you, and then it is your job as a monastic to almost like accept everything that lay people give you. And this sort of agreement kind of leads to all kinds of problems in life. This is also something lay people can also think about, right? What is how can you live a simple life, or live a life that is just right, so that it doesn't give rise to too many problems, too much work. Even if you have a big house, it is so much work having a big house. It's very nice to have a small place sometimes. Okay, so again, middle way, right? Don't allow the requisites to give rise to defilements, but also use them in such a way that they don't give rise to too much suffering by just living at the root of a tree, etc. Then we have the last one, reflecting wisely, yoniso patisankara. He uses the medicinal requisites only for protection from arisen afflicted feelings and for the benefit of good health. So you have in Buddhism, this is what we were talking about the other day, cheese and chocolate. Somebody said that cheese and chocolate wasn't such a big hindrance, but there were other things. But anyway, so you know the limits of these things, so that they are, again, middle way in everything here. This is what this is about. So now you are starting to get some idea what the meaning of this idea of sampajanya, right? Clear comprehension. You do things in such a way that you stick to the middle way here, that you are actually practicing this path so it works for you. That is what is actually meant here. So that is the first one. That is the taints to be abandoned by using. And then we move on to the next section here. And we're still in the realm of sampajanya. While taints, vexations, and fever... Okay, summary verse first of all. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no taints, no asavas. Vexation and fever, these are the defilements. Fever is just another way of talking about desire, right? In one who uses them thus, these are called the asavas, the defilements that should be abandoned by using, by the correct way of using, using in the right way. What taints, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by enduring? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. So again, this is enduring. Sometimes we have to endure, right? Sometimes there is suffering in life. Sometimes there are problems that you cannot do very much about. And when you cannot do anything about something, you have to learn to endure. You have to realize, and this is the power of realizing this, is that when you realize you cannot do anything about it, and when you really realize that, that is how you can endure. The reason we become upset about something, or the reason we get desires about things, is precisely because we think that we can control the world, right? That's why these defilements arise. You think you can control, and when you think you can control, anger arises. You get angry, I'm going to tell them off, I'm going to sort it all out. But if you realize fully that this is just nature is this way, you cannot do anything about it, then you can let go of that ill will or even that desire, because it actually is uncontrollable. And this is the point here with the weather or whatever. Sometimes as a monastic you may not get enough to eat. You go into the village and where people have moved or something has happened, and then you just deal with it and you endure that particular thing. And you don't actually worry about it or get upset or have too many desires or whatever. Sometimes it is hot. You have to endure the sun. We know that here in WA that sometimes it gets really hot, right? And then when you live in the coot in the forest, you're just going to have to endure that. Not much you can do about it sometimes. Sometimes the mosquitoes come into your room at night, buzzing around. And sometimes you lie awake, but other times you say, okay, whatever. If he wants to bite me, so be it. So this is just enduring of the things in the world that we cannot control. And it's useful to reflect on that. Just what can we control? What can't we control? And then you can deal with these things. And then you endure the ill-spoken, unwelcome words, right? And this is another thing which is so common in life, that we hear things we don't really want to hear. You know, every Perhaps every day sometimes we hear things that are not nice, that we don't want to hear. And yet, after a while you realize this is part of life, right? Hearing these things, we can't really control it. And because you can't control it, there's no reason to get upset. So you just allow it to be. You allow other people to worry about their own, this is their problem. If they say stupid things, I'm not going to make it mine. And you're just going to be even-minded and not worry about it. So again, it's all about understanding that you can't control it. And by understanding you can't control it, you can let go. And you can relax and you can be at ease with these things. So this is a lot of this is through the idea of non-self, right? You're not in charge of things, not in charge of the world. You're not in charge of things, you just, okay, whatever. It has to go its own way. And of course, one of the things that are the most difficult of all is often the bodily feelings that are painful, right? The physical body, I think somewhere the Buddha says that the physical body is like this abyss, right? It's this kind of chasm which kind of goes down forever. The body is a bottomless abyss of unpleasant feelings. I think that's what he says. And this is the problem with the body. And this is why sometimes meditation can be so pleasant, because you get away from the body, get away from this abyss of unpleasant feelings. That's what the Buddha calls the body, an abyss of unpleasant feelings. And because it goes on, it never stops, and usually gets worse and worse the older you get, right? More and more pains and aches, etc., etc. So again, you realize that, and when you recognize that, you are able to deal with it. You don't worry too much about it, and you just allow it to go. This doesn't mean that when you sit in meditation, you just watch the painful feelings. You can do that a little bit, but I wouldn't recommend it too much, because usually it's just a distraction. But what it means is that sometimes there are feelings you cannot do anything about, right? The mosquito bites, so you hit your head against something, you have some pain in the joints or whatever it is, and this is just life. Things just go this way. So you just deal with it that way. You don't get upset, you don't have too many desires, and you just accept these things, you endure them as they are. So this is important, and I think that most people tend to overestimate how much they can control their lives. We tend to overestimate how much we can control. This is the nature of having a sense of self. The very nature of having a sense of self is that we can control, right? This is what the sense of self, one of the main functions of the sense of self is to control the world. But if that self is an illusion, it suddenly changes things quite dramatically. If that is an illusion, then you start to realize that you just have to sit back and watch instead. This is one of the things. This is why it is so powerful to start to understand the idea of non-self. So this here kind of goes together with the reflection of non-self, that actually you are much more powerless with things than we sometimes like to think. And that undermines the ill will, it undermines the desire, because you take away this sense that I am going to be in charge, I'm going to control the world. And this is why you see on the Buddhist path, as you go through this, we're now kind of still in the territory of overcoming defilements, then we get into meditation afterwards. This is why once you get into meditation, deep meditation, and then you have the insights that come as a consequence of that. Once you see non-self, this is kind of the pivot point on the Buddhist path. Once you understand non-self, then everything starts to unravel. It's non-self which is the linchpin, if you like, the pin which holds everything together into place. Once that linchpin has been pulled out, then the wheel comes off the wagon, and then everything unravels. And that's when desires and ill will and everything else cannot really live any longer. They start to fade away because that linchpin is out. Deep down, we cannot control things anymore. This is what the idea of non-self is about to a large extent. So this idea of non-self is a very powerful thing. We are deluded by it, and then we keep on doing these crazy things. Once that delusion loses some of its foothold, then the things start to kind of unravel. So this is what we're doing here. We're trying to use that little bit, that idea of non-self, to undermine the defilements. This is part of what we're trying to do here. Okay, so you endure. That is the second way of clear comprehension. You know when you have to endure, and you know when you can do something, right? Two different categories there. So then we have the third aspect here. What bhikkhus, what taints should be abandoned by avoiding him? And here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts, associating with bad friends. Since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct, while taints, vexation and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things. There are no taints, vexations and fever in one who avoids them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. I'll come to that now. These are the things that you have to avoid. And some of these things may seem fairly obvious. You avoid a wild elephant, right? They can be very dangerous, these wild elephants. You avoid a wild dog, perhaps it has rabies or whatever. I don't know. The snake, you don't kind of step on the snakes. And sometimes I think the reason why all of this is here is probably because sometimes people are a bit foolhardy, right? They do things that are silly, they overestimate themselves, they think they're going to be really tough and go and live in the jungle. But sometimes you can be a bit too tough and then you end up injuring yourself really badly instead. So you are wise about this, you find the middle way. You're not too afraid of the animals, but you also know that they can be dangerous sometimes. And the same thing, I think, is stumpy. I'm not sure if that is what that actually is in the Pali, but I think the point is just that, you know, all of these things are basically dangerous places, a chasm, a bramble patch. You avoid the dangerous things in life. I think that's what it basically is about. Not sure exactly why stump is mentioned in this way. And of course, you avoid.
You can
kick your toe on stump. Yeah, right. So you avoid kicking your toe. That's a good point. Yeah, okay. So you don't have any excess pain in your toes. And then you avoid the cesspits and the sewer, right? That also kind of makes sense. So it just means you have common sense. You're not trying to you're trying to find a middle way. I think that's really all it means. And then the next part here is probably more interesting in many ways. And that is you avoid sitting on unsuitable seats, right? So for a monastic, sitting on unsuitable seats will be sitting in the company of the other gender in a private place, a secluded place. That will be a classical example of sitting on an unsuitable seat. Or, you know, sitting on the seat in the casino. That would be another example of an unsuitable seat. Any place where your defilements are likely to be stirred up, right? Or some kind of entertainment venue or something like that. These are all the unsuitable seats. So again, you just remember, well, where are your defilements likely to be stirred up? Where are the, you know, are you likely just looking for problems for yourself? So you avoid that. That's unsuitable seats. Unsuitable resorts is very similar. It's just resort, it just means any place you hang out, right? Any place you happen to be. So you avoid those unsuitable places where the defilements are going to. You don't go to Northbridge on the, you know, at night, or especially on the weekend. You know, that's not very helpful. And you don't really hang out in the city at all as a monastic. You try to avoid the city life, and you try to stay in the forest instead. It is quite tangible when you live in the forest for quite a long time. It's very tangible how different the feel is of living in the city compared to living in the forest. When you live in the city, you're always bombarded with everything, right? There's so much stuff coming your way that after a while you lose your ability to kind of be aware of what's happening in your mind. There's just too much. You can't really control things anymore. You lose your sense of restraint a little bit. And you get this feeling, there's this kind of vibe, you know, the feeling in the city of sensuality that is lost when you are, is no longer there in the forest. It's a very different feeling here. And it's very hard to keep that restraint going here when you live in the city for too long here. I can just feel, even though, you know, when we go into Nolamara, to the Dhammaloka on the weekends, we stay there for the weekend here. And even though we just stay at the Dhammaloka center, just sleeping there, just the feeling of sleeping there compared to sleeping in your little hut in the forest is a very, very different feeling here. It's just the whole atmosphere is very different. And it tends to stir you up in a way that the forest dwelling does not. You're probably feeling that a bit here when you're staying here, how peaceful it is to even sleep at night, right? It's a very different feel from the feeling in the city here. So this has all to do with unsuitable resorts. And then you have associating with bad friends. And again, we are so influenced by the people we are with, right? We are so conditioned by the company we keep. And because of that, you associate with bad friends, it tends to rub off on you, and it tends to make life more difficult. So if you're a monastic, it's best not to hang out with people who are criminals, right? If you hang out too much with criminals, then you end up becoming a criminal yourself, perhaps, after a while. So you tend to take on the characteristics of the people around you. So this is, again, all of this is about, you are wise, you know where your defilements are going to be stirred up, and you stay away from that. And the last one says, since if he were to do so, the wise companions in the spiritual life might suspect that person of bad conduct. And that, I think, is actually not quite the right translation. It is not so much that you are afraid that others will judge you. That's not really the point. The point is more that these are the kind of seeds where the wise people say, this is where your defilements will be stirred up. So you stay away from them, because more like the recommendation of the wise people. The wise people say, this is a bad place to be. So you stay away from that. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you stay away because you are afraid to be told off later on. That's not the right motivation. The motivation is more an understanding of what is bad. So you avoid things. So you are, again, you have clear comprehension about avoiding things. While taints, vexation, and fear might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no taints, asavas, vexation, and fear in one who does avoid them. These are called the asavas that should be abandoned by avoiding. So that is sampajana. This is my understanding of sampajana, and it is a bit different from what you would normally hear. But I think this is a very practical way of understanding it, and as far as I can see, it is borne out by the suttas and how it is used in the suttas. You will often see that sampajanya, particularly this idea that we were reading out before from the gradual training about moving and acting in full awareness when going forward and going back and all these things. This is often said to be included in the Satipatthana normally. This is a paragraph in the Satipatthana. So the question then arises, is this part of Satipatthana practice? Or is it maybe something that we should be doing generally, like I've been talking about now? And it's not entirely theoretical, because it is the question about what Satipatthana really is all about. I think that there is a good argument that this actually does not really belong to Satipatthana. It belongs to the part of the path which comes prior to that, that we're dealing with now. We're trying just to avoid defilements in daily life. This is quite a different interpretation from what you normally will hear. One of the reasons for that is because the Satipatthana Sutta, and this has been, I think, shown fairly clearly by a number of scholars, is a very complex sutta that is very likely to have been built up over time. If you compare the Chinese version with the Pali version, there's two different Chinese versions, there's also one in Sanskrit, and there is certain versions that exist apart from that. And when you compare them all, there's a lot of discrepancy and differences. And what that points to is that this sutta has been probably built up and kind of expanded over time, and new things have been added. Not on purpose to this, you know, to anything like that, but just this is the nature of what happens in oral traditions. So because of that, you have to be a little bit careful in what actually Satipatthana is all about. And there is an interesting sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya which talks about sati sampajanya. You often hear this word, sati sampajanya, and the feeling you get when you hear that is that sati and sampajanya go together. But what this sutta says is that it says that sampajanya is this, what we have been talking about now. That's sampajanya, whereas sati is satipatthana. So it divides it up and says one thing is this, and another thing is satipatthana. They are two distinct entities that are separated from each other. So for that reason, I personally, this is perhaps a little bit theoretical, but for those of you who are interested in kind of these kind of issues, there is a distinction there between sampajanya and satipatthana. Satipatthana is what we are moving towards. Satipatthana is just meditation, for those of you who are not aware of these words. Satipatthana just means meditation practice. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But we are still in the area where we're moving towards satipatthana. Once you get to satipatthana, once you get to meditation, you're talking about sitting down, putting your legs cross-legged, and then watching your breath, and that sort of thing. That's what satipatthana is. So this is still in those prior stages, getting ready for these things, abandoning the defilements, building up enough good qualities in your mind, so you are ready for meditation practice. This is what this is all about. So there you are. That is a clear comprehension for you. We're coming very close now to the culmination of the Buddhist path, and it gets, as we move along here, it gets kind of more and more exciting, because these states, the more close you get to the goal, the more kind of amazing these states are. So the next thing I want to have a look at, I'm going to go a little bit back again in this sutta that you have. Going back just before the Ratapala Sutta, which we looked at this morning. And just before the Ratapala Sutta, there is quite a long sutta called Mahanama. Mahanama, AN 6:10, Mahanama. And I will have a look at that sutta tomorrow morning. And then we will do the final sutta on Sunday morning. Can you find the Mahanama Sutta, AN 6:10? I probably do that one as well. Yeah, that will be included. Yeah. So that will be the next one for tomorrow morning here. Okay, so please keep on enjoying yourself, and I will see you again this evening. Thank you.